thanks for joining us once again on Core Ideas, the podcast dedicated to all things lake sediments. And as always, my name is Adam Jaziorski, and joined by my good friend Josh Steenpond.
Hey, how's it going?
It is going good. And it is going good because today we're continuing our arc on topical paleolimnology. And we have a very special guest joining us for the conversation, which is very cool.
Yeah. Our third guest. Yeah. This is getting to be a real thing.
Yeah.
We're roping people who don't live in our house or are our boss to and our former supervisor to be guests. So that's great.
Talk to us.
So thanks very much to that guest.
Yep.
Do you want to introduce him?
So I guess we'll kind of set it up by we're continuing the current arc on, you know, hot topics in paleolimnology. And what we wanted to talk about this time was bioeffectors or bioeffector transport. And we thought, it's not something I know very much about. And you're shaking your head, and now there's Josh.
No, not really.
So we thought we'd bring in an expert. And I happen to work with one in the lab group whose name is Matt Duda. He's a PhD candidate at Queen's University, who works on biovectors and paleolimnology, specifically impacts of large bird colonies on small ponds in oceanic islands. And it's very timely having him talk with us today because he is one of this year's co-winners of the Peters Award given by the Society of Canadian Limnologists.
Yeah, and we've talked about the Peters Award a couple times, but that's the award given to a Canadian student or a student studying in Canada for the best paper, first authored paper of that year. And this year, Matt is one of the co-winners, and you know, we'll hopefully try and rope Madison Bell, who is the other co-winner, into an episode in the future, because I think her research would be very much also a good contributing topic to topical paleolimnology, or just a really interesting episode as well. But no, congrats to both of them. It's the first time we've said that. But it was very topical that this fit into the topics we were already interested in talking about.
Yeah. And we'll put links to the award-winning paper in the show notes. But it was published last year in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, and is called Striking Centennial Scale Changes in the Population Size of a Threatened Seabird. And let's get into it. Here's our conversation with Matt. So today on the show, we have Matt Duda as a guest host to help talk us about biovectors in general. And he recently won, or is the current winner of this year's Peters Award, which is the award given to SCL for the best student written paper, best written paper by a Canadian student, our co-winner. There were two winners this year. And his work on biovectors in that paper, which we'll get to later, is part of the reason that we asked him to join us here today. So welcome, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No problem. And full disclosure, Matt is a member of the Pearl Lab, and we've known each other for a couple of years, and used to see each other on a regular basis in the before times.
Yeah. Has he like grown his hair out to like shoulder length or something while he's been locked in his house? Wouldn't he be funny?
It's quite the opposite. His beard's a bit more trimmed since the last time I saw him.
Yeah, I just recently had to clean up a little bit. It's looking a bit too Bushman.
Getting ready for whenever everything opens up again, you can go back in. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. So in our current arc, we're talking about topical issues or subjects within paleolimnology. And today we're going to talk about biovectors. And for those that are not familiar with the term, that's referring to when biological organisms basically transfer something from somewhere to somewhere else. And if you do some Google searches on the term, it's often related to epidemiology and disease, but that's not what we're talking about today. So we're not talking about bats or pangolins in a 2020 sense. We're talking about the unidirectional focusing of a contaminant into a particular location. And within paleolimnology, usually what we're talking about when we're talking about biovectors is contaminants and or nutrients. And typically, paleontologists are interested in the signals or markers left in lake sediments showing either large quantities of a substance being transported or substances being transported large distances from one environment to another. And the most striking example, and one that Matt knows a lot about, is from marine to terrestrial, to freshwater or terrestrial environments. And there are a couple of big kind of, I guess, marquee examples in this general topic. You have the iconic images of salmon bringing large amounts of marine nutrients to their spawning lakes. You have people like the Thule whalers, so the predecessors of the Inuit and the Inuk peoples in like northern regions, where they captured whales or hunted whales and brought them inland to butcher and at their villages more inland. And so it'd be a huge source of nutrients in the small ponds in their village areas. And then also seabird colonies with the huge amounts of guano that basically rolled downhill from the colonies into freshwaters on the colony islands. So acting as a huge source of fertilization for these environments. Did I say that right, Matt?
Yeah, that all makes sense. Yep, I would agree.
And really, what makes this interesting is it's a real uphill nature of the within this topic, because biovector transport is happening all over the place, all the time. But what we really care about is when it's basically being transported in the reverse of the typical energy flow. So we care about when marine nutrients brought into terrestrial environments, because really that's like a reversal of the normal way of things. There's much less kind of interest per se in the biovector nature of terrestrial nutrients flowing downstream into a marine environment, because the magnitude of that is just giant of what's happening naturally. Whereas pulling in a giant well beside a small, you know, 1 or 2 hectare pond would be a huge change to that small environment. And in paleontology, you know, we choose what we look at as indicators based on what we can measure. And in this case, we talked about a bunch of things before in terms of nutrient indicators, so things like diatoms or stable isotopes, because even if when we are interested in nutrients, those can't be measured directly in the sediments due to mobility. And so this is where we can get really into the meat of Matt's work with seabirds, because, you know, in his examples, looking at the potential fertilization of these remote island ponds, he was using these sort of indirect markers to measure changes in colony size through time. Do you want to maybe just give a brief background of Baklu Island and what drew you to that problem for the work you did there with the storm petrels?
Yeah, absolutely. So with my work, I wasn't necessarily interested in Baklu Island initially. What I was interested in were the birds, the storm petrels. So Leach's storm petrels are one of the most abundant seabirds that we have in Canada. And they have a global impact because of how much nutrients they're able to transfer from the marine ecosystem into the terrestrial one. The problem with storm petrels, though, is that they're nocturnal and they're really small. And that means for people who are trying to survey them and understand their population sizes, it's really difficult. Traditionally, with storm petrels and other birds, the way that you would survey their population size and census it is using banding and marked recapture. But for birds like storm petrels that nest on remote islands that are nocturnal, they're hard to get to, it's a huge amount of effort to do a single count. And what that ends up causing is really few and sparse surveying points. So over the last 30 or 40 years, since the 1980s for storm petrels specifically, we only have a handful of census and survey data. And based on the available data, it appears that the storm petrel population is declining really dramatically and really quickly. Around 30% of the global population has declined. And that, as concrete numbers, is several million storm petrels. And the problem is, because we have a lack of this long-term data, lots of surveying, it's hard to tell how much has the population actually declined. If we pull the scale back beyond the 1980s, when that first survey happened, was the population of storm petrels higher, or was it lower and now it's fluctuating up and down? Without regular data, we have no idea of what's going on. But like you mentioned about biovectors, storm petrels are really good at transporting, concentrating lots of nutrients and metals and other biological products. And the reason why they do that so well is because they form these really large and dense colonies. So over the winter, when they're not breeding, they sit along the oceans for the Atlantic population between the west coast of Africa and Brazil. But then when it becomes breeding season in April, all of the birds, all the storm petrels en masse return to where they were born into these big breeding colonies, and they can number in several millions of birds. And all of those birds are on these really small remote islands. They prefer remote islands because there's no predators there, especially mammal predators, because they can't get there. And on these islands with the millions of birds, they all start defecating. They all raise their chicks, which means that there's eggshells that are being washed in. Any kind of carcasses are all being washed in, which fertilizes the entire terrestrial environment and fertilizes inadvertently the aquatic environment, which then accumulates in the sediments. And then we can get at the sediments and do a paleo reconstruction to start to look at the long-term population dynamics. So to get at your original question about Baccaloo, the reason why we chose that one is because it's the largest colony of storm petrels in the world. And so the main thing that we're always trying to do with biovector work is get an ideal noise to signal ratio. With lots and lots of birds on a small pond, then you have lots of signal relative to the amount of noise that might interfere with what we're actually trying to look at. If you don't have a lot of birds, or the pond is too big, or the lake is too big, then you start to introduce lots of noise, and then we can't really get a strong signal of the population dynamics, which is in the end what we're trying to get at.
So it's a combination in trying to, or being able to reconstruct the impact on the environment, the terrestrial, the aquatic, but also this conservation or potential conservation angle, looking at the dynamics of the population. That's interesting to be able to do both of those things at the same time. Two applied uses of paleolimnology in one study organism or one study sort of location.
Yeah, exactly.
And just for the like background, these are, so you said they're a small bird. Are they piscivorous? Like they eat fish primarily? What is there looking? Because we've talked a little bit about nutrients and where organisms fall in terms of their isotope composition based on the food web, et cetera. So where would these little guys fit in that sort of spectrum?
Yes. Yeah, so storm petrels are operotrophic organisms. They have a varied diet. Sometimes they eat small fish. So lanternfish is a really common prey food for them. They also will eat small copepods and squids and other little nekton. The way that the storm petrels feed is they fly over the surface and then they just skim anything that's off of the top of the ocean, and then they eat it and then they bring it back to wherever they have their breeding colony.
And then also in the background info, I guess we should say exactly, we've been referring to Baccaloo Island as if everyone knows exactly where it is. You don't know where Baccaloo Island is?
Adam started it, so.
I've been so entrenched in this project for the last several years that I just figure everybody knows what it is. Everyone I talk to knows where it is. But Baccaloo Island, it's a 6 kilometer long island off of the east coast of Newfoundland and Labrador, around 60 kilometers north of St. John's, which is the major city there. It's a really special place because it's an ecological reserve specifically established to protect storm petrels and other birds like puffins and gannets that nest there. and it becomes a more significant problem that we're trying to overcome is that the population still seems to like it's declining, even though it's now an ecological reserve. So that adds to the problem. We're trying to figure out what's going on, because clearly it's not human interference if the population is protected on the colony, or maybe it's human interference beyond the colony itself, you know, a more marine impact that is influencing the birds.
And assumedly there are some lakes on this little island that are the focus of your particular methodological interest, if not interest in the overall project.
Yeah, no, we're very fortunately, Baklu Island has several ponds. We call them ponds, even though they are lakes. We call them ponds because in Newfoundland, they indiscriminately call lakes and ponds ponds. That's just a way of, that's for some reason in Newfoundland, that's the way it is. Yeah, there's several. They're all like a couple thousand meters squared. So pretty small comparatively to most things that you would study in Ontario or the rest of North America.
Okay. And then one other question, because I was like looking at the paper in Proceedings B again earlier this morning. And one thing jumped out at me in like kind of the background info about the storm petrel that I guess I'd heard in like your presentation stuff before, but never really, caught on exactly what that meant. So this is the largest colony, because I'm not super familiar with seabirds in general. So it's the largest colony of the leach storm petrel in the world. But then it was like, so 50% of the global population comes back to this one colony to breed. So they, I guess they scatter all over the place. Is that a normal thing for a particular, like a seabird colony species to be so concentrated globally in like one small location? Like, I don't know, is that something weird about storm petrels that almost every storm petrel in the world comes to this one island to breed? Or is that a fairly common kind of colonial seabird behavior?
Yeah, so it's actually pretty common for seabirds. I believe the number recently is 95% of seabirds are colonial. But the size of the colony is very dependent on a lot of things like habitat availability, prey availability, and interspecies interactions. So with storm petrels, they're very small and honestly quite weak relative to other seabirds. You know, if you think about other big birds like fulmars and gannets, they are much more robust compared to storm petrels. You know, there's evidence of storm petrels flying out to feed, and then they come back and they're missing feet because a fish has eaten one of their feet out in the ocean. Yeah. So they have to form these really large, dense colonies to really protect themselves from any kind of predators. There's evidence of owls predating them. Their prey while they're out feeding out in the ocean. They're bullied by other birds. So they have to form really dense colonies to kind of counteract that. You know, the metapopulation of storm petrels really requires a robust genetic flow and robust population dynamics to support these kind of birds.
Okay. And then going into your study, what were the, I guess, so the concern was they'd been in decline between the, since the 1980s, the survey conducted in the 1980s. Before you like got ruling, what were the potential mechanisms of the decline? Like what was it being blamed upon? Or thought to be?
So we started off the project with two main questions. We wanted to go back and see, is the population truly in decline? And we only had two surveys to begin with, one in 1984 and the second one in 2012. Those two data points look like the population had declined by around 40%, but two data points really isn't enough and isn't conclusive. So we were hoping that our paleo data would either support or refute that the population is actually in decline. The second main thing that we wanted to look at is if we extend that time scale, if we can go back 100 years, 200 years, was the population higher before the 1980s survey? Was it lower? What is the longer context, the temporal context for the population trend or decline that was supposedly seen by the surveys?
And what indicators did you use to answer that question?
Yeah, so we used a lot of really well-established paleo proxies. The first one was nitrogen 15 or delta N15. That's really, you guys have talked about all the isotopes, so I don't need to go into too much detail about N15, but suffice it to say that a higher N15 is just introductions from high trophic organisms. Then we used ornithogenic diatoms, or diatoms that are related to the inputs of storm petrels, so things like nutrients and metals. We used chironomids to examine changes in the pH or oxygen of the bottom of the lakes. And then we also used metals that are highly correlated to storm petrels. So because they're high trophic organisms, they bioaccumulate and biomagnify certain metals. The ones that we found are most correlated to storm petrels are cadmium and zinc. And then we also used sedimentary chlorophyll A, so more birds, more nutrients, which means that more general productivity. And then finally, we used cholesterol, which is a biomolecule correlated to animal introductions.
So six different indicators, which is, that's a lot, you know, a lot for any one study. Can you just summarize the findings in that study? And then we can dig a bit deeper.
Yeah. So six proxies is a lot, but I guess the important thing to establish is that, unfortunately, there's no one magic proxy that can get us bird trends. Otherwise, I'd be all on top of that. So unfortunately, we have to use several different proxies that all hopefully corroborate one another. And by the more corroboration that you get from all of your proxies, the stronger evidence you have that what you think you're reconstructing in the past is truly what we're thinking it is. You know, all of our proxies all show the same trend, which means that we have really strong evidence that it is seabird trends when we look back in time in the sediment. What we found was that when you go back, we actually got a 1700-year record across five different lakes, and they all show the same thing, that the storm petrel population reached a peak around the 1980s. So when that initial survey happened, we corroborated that, yeah, the population is in decline. But the most interesting aspect, or more interesting aspect to me at least, was that it appears that the population started to increase around the 1800s, reached a peak in the 1980s, and then started to decline. And then when you go further beyond that, going back in time, there's a large, long period of essentially a hiatus where there were very few birds. And then around 500 CE, we have another peak in the storm petrel population. So there's an increase, decrease, around 500 CE when there was no human interference or human impact. And then around 1800 CE, when we do have humans around that Baccalieu Island near St. John's, the population still increased. Now we have these really interesting results, but it unfortunately also ends up bringing up more questions. You know, what's causing these fluctuations or cycles in the population size? And that's something that we're still trying to explore right now.
Yeah, like that's interesting, because then it's telling you that the colony declined, but you have no information, for example, if for some reason the birds bred at the next island over for some period of time or something like that. Like, so where would the second largest colony be located? Like, not too far away?
In Japan.
Oh, okay. So they didn't, just moving next door isn't quite an option.
Yeah. So that actually brings up the second part of what I was doing in my PhD research, which was looking at the long-term dynamics of a secondary large colony. Because there's varying surveying data, it's either the third or the fourth largest colony, but that doesn't really matter. In St. Pierre and Miquelon, which is around 270 kilometers southwest of Baccalieu, so opposite corner of Newfoundland, and there's a really large colony of storm petrels there. And so based on the results from the Baccalieu study, it appears that some kind of intercolony dynamics is happening. And the reason, the way to look at that is to look at a nearby colony and see if that also has these increases and decreases. And so when we did that and we went back in time using similar proxies, we found that on Grand Colombier Island, which is in Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, when the Baculoo population was at a maximum, the other colony was at a minimum. And then when that reversed, the secondary colony increased again while the first one declined. So it appears like there's an asynchronous or puzzle-like population trends between the two colonies, supporting the idea that when there's a pressure on one island, the storm petrels will move to a different island. And then when there's a pressure on that one, say there's not enough habitat, there's a predator on the island, they'll move somewhere else.
So the problem becomes more complex the further you dig into it.
Yeah, but more interesting, I would argue as well.
Are there any more records for this Japanese island? Like, do they have longer records of actual counts, or have they ever tried to do similar reconstructions?
They haven't, but I do think that it's interesting, and it's something that I think that there's interest in doing. A lot of the paleo work, unfortunately, so far is focused in either North America or North Americans going to Antarctica and reconstructing penguin populations. It's a booming field right now with a lot of really interesting questions that can be addressed using either genetic work, if you want to get at really long timescales, you know, beyond 10,000 years like you can with paleo. And then with paleo, the more recent in quotations, up to 10,000 years. So I think it's inevitable that the Japanese colony will be one of the ones to do next.
There you go. Sounds like some cool field work and a postdoc. Yeah. It's all lined up.
Just need the funding, right? That's happy it. To yeah. do it.
Yeah, that's cool. And then I guess since we've been talking about biovectors, that's a very good summary of the population dynamics, but just thinking about the metals as a contaminant, because we talked about nutrients and that makes sense. What did you see that one corroborated quite well, that we have an increase in those, do you say cadmium and zinc? So some of those metals at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. They corroborate really strongly. Actually, we sometimes call them bioelements. You know, the metals that are correlated to organism introductions, they're often the proxies that most reflect population dynamics. They're often quite stable in sediments. You know, they don't fluctuate too much. And there's so many different elements that themselves can actually corroborate one another. You know, we've got cadmium and zinc, but then you could also start to look at arsenic, which can be bioaccumulated by organisms. The same thing with mercury, which biomagnifies. We focused on two that are the most strongly correlated to storm petrels, but different seabirds will increase different metals depending on their diet, their trophic status, where they're feeding, several things like that.
Cool. Yeah. What they're feeding on. Yeah. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. So is the fact that they eat a range of stuff make that a little more complicated? Like if they were a really stenophagous species, like they just picked one food item and stuck to mussels, for example, and got all the things that are filtered by mussels, would that make it easier, do you think? Do they become a little difficult compared to some other taxa that way?
Yeah, I think it would be much easier if they were really specific with their diet, especially when you start to go back in time. If an organism is a generalist, then we don't know whether or not the reason why the proxies have decreased is because they're simply eating something else. And so we're not getting the same cadmium and zinc introductions. If an organism was very specific and had to eat, say, mollusks, you would know that the introduction of those specific metals would stay consistent throughout the entire temporal record. It's just something we got to deal with. And again, that's another reason why multiple proxies, looking at it from different angles, from nutrients, from metals, cholesterols, it all has to line up for us to feel like we've got a true, proper signal.
And do you find that the signal from things like contaminants of that nature kind of tails away as you get out of the more modern period when there assumedly is less contamination in the environment that they're going to be incorporating. So that one sort of in 1700 years ago, I think you said, might not be as strong as it is now in this soup that they're swimming around in.
But I think that that would be true if we looked at metals that have been increased or released in higher concentrations due to anthropogenic activities like mercury.
Sure.
I think mercury you'd have a diminishing signal back in time.
Or POPs or something like that.
Exactly.
Persistent pollutants, yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Whereas those are natural contaminants in the environment, but just part of the cycle of geology. No, that's cool. That makes
exactly
sense.
Right.
Just from a general study design point of view, did you go in planning to look at such a diverse suite of indicators, or is it like more of a layers of an onion in response to questions, or was the goal always, we're going to do diatoms, isotopes, the whole shebang right from the get-go?
My initial goal was to do as few proxies as possible to answer the questions that I was interested in.
That's the right answer.
But the further back in time we went and the more interesting the question got, I dug into it, and then it did become like an onion. You know, we started off with chlorophyll A and diatoms. Those had really interesting results. We knew we wanted to do isotopes because isotopes are one of the most well-established proxies for biovectors. We had to look at that. And then we went and continued expanding and went on to look at the more ecosystem type changes that the seabirds would have. And that's why we got into chironomids. And then that's why we added on the cholesterol, you know, these different aspects, different avenues. It didn't start off this way. You know, my initial proposal was much, much barer than what it ended up becoming. But I'm really happy that we ended up going down all of these routes.
Yeah, no, I would imagine many proposals have the reverse. It's like you have to pare down when you realize the daunting task that you've laid out before yourself. Interesting hearing about one that, no, we had to keep ramping up. We had to keep ramping up based on the data that was coming back, which is cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
So after, spending so much time looking at so many different indicators from Baklu Island, is it sayonara to storm petrels? Are you moving on to something else?
No, it's my favorite bird now. It didn't start off that way, but I'm invested now. You know, we still haven't figured out how to conserve the storm petrels, and we still haven't figured out why the population has declined by 30%. So I'm still after it. There are two main things that I still want to do with my PhD project. The first is to go back to Baklu and extend the time scale up to 10,000 years. You know, we have 1,700 years of population dynamics, and they show really interesting trends. But then the question becomes, what about if we go back further, all the way back to the last glaciation of Newfoundland? And that's as long as we can get that sediment record. And then the second part, yeah, go ahead.
So I guess we didn't cover this before. That sounds like a major undertaking. Like how long were your sediment profiles to get back 1700 years ago?
Around 40 centimeters.
Oh, okay. Oh. So they're relatively, even with the colony. Okay. Cause it's not like, a serious, like I was thinking, these are small islands. How do you get there? Going back to a full glacial, post-glacial period would be a serious undertaking, but I guess.
It's like being in the Arctic. It's like maybe 3 meters of mud in that lake. And that's about it.
Yeah. So we went back and we collected the full record, and it's around 4 meters long, which is still an undertaking in itself, but you know,
manageable.
Manageable. Not as if it here in Ontario, it would have been much, much longer, I can imagine, to get 10,000 years of a record.
Yeah. Probably 12 meters here. Something is kind of, I mean, the range is hugely, but that would be a good guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been an undertaking. I don't know if I would have wanted to do that.
So that's cool. And what would you expect? I mean, have you started on that already? Is that like, we don't want to steal any thunder here, but yeah, all the same proxies and like, will you be doing, because that's a lot, is, you know, 40 centimeters is a lot of work to do six different indicators on. 4 meters is another thing entirely. So
yeah, and with that, it's 4 meters and I'm doing two lakes so that they're the two lakes on the island so that they corroborate one another. And then I also have a reference core that's 2 meters long. So because I'm doing so many lakes in total at around 10 meters, it's just going to be the main proxies that are really strongly representative of storm petrels that we've identified from the first study. So diatoms, isotopes, nitrogen, and probably carbon-13, as well as the cadmium and zinc. So fewer proxies, but a much longer record. And hopefully by having two cores, two lakes nearby that can corroborate one another, we still have a strong signal of the overall island trends.
Because that's like three stories of sediment, like three-story building of mud.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I know.
Awesome. But that makes sense. And also some of them are more time-intensive, like sterols are a fair bit of lab work versus nitrogen isotopes, which, you know, take some time and the amount of sediment. So that makes sense to focus in really closely on the things you expect are going to be really good indicators.
Exactly, yeah.
I guess and another thing is we jumped kind of into this really quickly. And then you just made me think of it again by talking about reference ponds. So with these, like, how different are the, like, visually from being there, are the reference ponds from the impacted ponds? Like, can you just, like, outside of the fact that there being a million birds around, presumably, and birds' nests around, like, is it pretty visual? Like, you don't need to do any in-depth analysis to know, okay, this is a very different pond from that environment, like, 20 meters away or something.
Yeah. So the reference ponds that we use for Baccaloo are, I think, 4 kilometers apart. And the terrestrial environment is strikingly different. On Baccaloo, where the birds are, it's extremely lush, productive. There's huge amounts of ferns. There's mosses. There's krumholz trees all over the place, you know, lush. And then when you look at the water chemistry, it's super high in phosphorus and nitrogen and metals, all the things that you would expect. Only 4 kilometers west of Baccaloo on Newfoundland Island, there's the reference pond. It's pretty barren all the way around it. The ecotype around the reference pond is called hyperoceanic barrens. If that gives you any impression, you know, you're walking on it and it's just really dry sphagnum mosses and pitcher plants. So it's still acidic, but there's very little nutrients. You know, it's just looking at the two, it's completely obvious that there's something different going on.
That's cool.
Biovectors indeed.
Yeah.
And I guess, again, in terms of like the long-term record and the impacts of people that didn't show up in your early work, are the petrels, or have they been actively hunted by people at any point, or are they just kind of left alone on that island?
Yeah, so this brings up an interesting thing. Maybe I'll segue into my second project on Grand Colombier based on this. So storm petrels generally are not hunted because they're really small and they're oily and they're not very tasty. When I was doing a little bit of background research, trying to write a discussion, I went to the local library here at Queen's and found some old sailors' records from Newfoundland. And there's evidence of them showing up to these islands and trying to eat a bunch of the birds. You know, puffins were edible, but the evidence was that storm petrels were called worth nothing to eat. And they were just, you can imagine this small, oily, nocturnal bird, not so good. But because they're so oily, what they ended up doing is they stuck a wick through the bird and they used them as candles, which is wild. Yeah. You know, there's pictures from museums of sailor museums that have storm petrels that have a wick still in them. So That said, there's millions of storm petrels, so we didn't suspect that that would be a major impact on the bird population. You know, taking a few of them for candles, not really that bad. But we still do suspect that European and human settlement in the Newfoundland area did have an impact on the storm petrel populations. When we look at the second colony, Grand Colombier in Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon, the reason why we were really interested in that colony when I started that project is the population looked stable based on the few surveys from the 1980s until present. There were a couple hundred thousand birds, but this is one of the largest colonies in the world. And so we asked ourselves, well, why is this one stable when all over the world, every other storm petrel colony appears to be in decline by 30% or more? Is there something special about the island? Is there something special about the water around it? Can we investigate the sediment cores from this colony and then look back in time and be able to understand the special dynamics that are special conditions that need to be present to support a storm petrel population? And then that can influence how we can conserve the storm petrels in the future, what we can do based on Grand Colombier, and then put that those conditions on Baccalieu to support the colony. So what we did is we collected a sediment core from Grand Colombier and we went back in time. We did the exact same thing, looked at several proxies. And what we found was really surprising. We went back 5,800 years and we saw fluctuations in the population size. You know, that supported what we saw on Baccalieu Island, and that wasn't too surprising. The part that was surprising is that the colony is actually near its lowest that it's been in the 5,800 years record. And the population started to decline around the turn of the 19th century, which lines up exactly with when European settlers arrived and set up a colony around Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon. You know, the difference between Grand Colombier, or the main difference between Grand Colombier and Baccalieu, is that Grand Colombier is only a few kilometers from a major city settlement, whereas Baccalieu is over 60 kilometers from a major settlement. So we suspected that nearby humans might have some kind of impact. But when we went back in time, we saw that the population was stable, and then around 1816, when Europeans arrived, the population crashed rapidly. It began to give us evidence that it's actually the human settlement nearby that caused the population to decline. There's several things that human settlement can do to negatively influence a seabird colony. You know, for storm petrels, yeah, they can be used as candles, but the other main aspect is they are strongly influenced by flaring. So ship traffic and any kind of nearby lights during night, because they're nocturnal, can screw up their migration and cause the population to decline. And then nearby human settlement can cause fishing and other kind of warming impacts that might cause the population to decline. So we ended up tying the population decline in storm petrels on Grand Colombier to European settlement.
Interesting.
The light thing is interesting. They could be influenced by something, especially at a time when we don't think of the huge light pollution that you see from modern cities, but it's sufficient to be an influence because they're sensitive to it and their activities. That's cool.
Yeah, especially strong for nocturnal migratory seabirds like storm petrels. So, yeah.
There you go. Cool.
Very cool stuff. It's really interesting work, and we're really glad that you spent a bit of time coming and sharing all with us.
Thank you for having me. Love to talk about it. I need to get more people interested in storm petrels. You know, they're one of the most abundant birds that we have in Canada, but so few people know about them.
Yeah, no, until, becoming familiar with your work, Matt, I don't think I'd even heard of Leach's storm petrel before. But that has changed.
Good. Yeah, there you go. Job done, right?
Exactly.
Well, and your work has had quite a, you know, the work has had some media attention from the first paper that we started talking about, but then this more recent one in PNAS. So I don't think it's just us. I'm sure some people who probably already are a little attuned to environmental kinds of stories, but may not know the specifics of it. And that's the goal for sure. So yeah, great.
100%.
Thanks again, Matt, for talking to us about your research on biovectors. It's really interesting. And the show notes, I'll link all your papers and so that people can look up what we're talking about. But as we say goodbye, is there anything you'd like to draw attention to, or how can people contact you if they were going to send you funding or
fan mail,
you know, tickets to Japan to study the petrol colonies there?
Yeah, I'm easily contactable by Gmail. So just mattp, as in Paul, Duda, @gmail.com. Or you can go to my website, matthewpduda.com. It's got all of my work there with descriptions of the work. And again, you can reach me from there. So that's my two ways.
Fantastic.
Very good.
And thanks again for spending the time chatting with us today.
Thank you so much.
All right, so that was our chat with Matt about his award-winning research, I guess, on, what we originally pitched as a discussion on biovectors, but having listened to it and having had that discussion, ended up having almost an equal, if not greater, contribution to thinking about conservation and conservation of a species and the way in which natural archives could be used to track species that don't have as good mark and recapture kind of population studies, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think that definitely highlights how interconnected questions can be and, you know, how one question can spark off or one answer can spark off a million more questions. And I thought it was kind of interesting in particular, you know, we asked him to talk to us today about the Proceedings B paper. And then it's just very much a piece in a puzzle. And the next piece has already been done and out. And, you know, the next layer of the onion has been peeled back and in PNAS.
I don't know. Was that a 2021? I don't think we have ever given two Peters Awards to the same person from SCL. But, you know, that's another really well. It depends on how, if you look at impact factor as the only component, which it certainly is not, but a bigger paper in some ways.
Yeah, no.
So tons of work that they've been doing.
I think it's a 2020 paper as well, but just much later in the year. So maybe be a candidate for maybe a back-to-back Peters Award winner. Who knows?
Could happen. You never know. Yeah.
And
Adam only has one Peters Award. Matt, you could have two. So
yeah.
And Josh has zero. Of course, I think that goes without saying. No. It was a good chat. It was nice to hear a little bit more about Matt's research, because he and I never overlapped at Queen's. And so I've seen him talk at maybe one or two conferences very early on in his program, and just to see how fully developed and integrated and really kind of dynamic it's become is nice to see and really cool to see. Some great stuff there and some interesting things, whether you're interested in, you know, you're a birder who's interested in population dynamics and how they move between different islands and under different stressors, or you're interested in contaminants and the way in which they can feed at different trophic levels and have sort of very broad diets and bring in a mixture of interesting contaminants, or you're interested in the impact that has on fertilization on the lakes. There's lots in this story. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing that's common amongst many biovector or animal vector stories, is that there is a real plethora of information and a real breadth of material that can tell you about not just the lake, not just the local catchment, not just the species, but all of it together.
Yeah. And what's interesting or funny in many ways is that material is often poo.
It is interesting that that's the case, isn't it?
And
I mean, if you think about what animals move around the environment, it's, you know, we might, you know, all of our knowledge might be on our cell phones, but that's a human construct. And for other species,
they're more limited.
It's often going to be a waste product that tells the story of their day and where they were and the environment that they found themselves in. And it's not just birds, even though a lot of the examples are based on birds, but there are lots of others, like bats, for example, don't nest around lakes, but
yeah,
have, I think, copious amounts of guano.
Yeah. So like interesting of like, so this is a kind of a funny topic that we can maybe explore in a future episode, but not, you're leaving the, I guess, realm of paleolimnology in a lot of these cases, but using paleolimnological techniques in, when you're looking at other places where poop piles up, and so and coring the poop per se. So there, I can think just off the top of my head of examples of old, I guess historical chimneys where you would have had a chimney swift colony, so you can core the deposits that have accumulated at the bottom of the chimney. The massive bat caves in more tropical locations. And I guess one thing that strikes me when you see these kind of studies is like, oh my goodness. Like, you know, I view the field work of paleomology that we've done as like one of the perks of the job of like, you know, hopping in a canoe, going somewhere in the boreal shield, collecting a couple of cores, all very nice, very scenic. But these collecting cores from these back caves seems like, you know, you're descending into hell in many ways.
Oh yeah, the first step is abseiling down into a bat and insect infested cave that's hotter than the fires of hell. Yeah.
On a quest for guano.
And dark, like pitch dark.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm glad I have no interest in doing that myself, but I'd be quite interested in spending a little time talking about the poor souls that do those kind of labors.
Yeah, we talk about those kind of archives in some of our like more general biogeography courses, and there are lots. Penguin rookeries, there's some stratigraphic records, pack rat middens, which isn't poop, it's pee, because they pee all over their hordes that they make, that they bring together. But they're really interesting. And the interesting thing that we can get into in a future episode is that they often are places where there aren't that many lakes. Like there aren't that many freshwater ecosystems in drier locations where rats live or bats nest. So they really fill that same function. So yeah, I think that that'd be a good way to jump off of Matt's introduction to a new episode that's not really the paleolimnology podcast, but paleo environmental broadly.
Yeah. And then as we keep going, working with guano, it just is ripe for poop jokes and poop puns, which is, you know, universally funny to everyone. Yep. And I just feel like sharing, I was told a made up joke by my eldest daughter very recently, and I thought it was fantastic, so I'm going to share with all two of our listeners. So here we go, Mom. Why did Elsa take so long on the toilet?
I don't know why.
Because she couldn't let it go.
Insert laugh track, Josh. Editing Josh, insert laugh track.
And
no, that's funny.
But
was she very pleased with herself when she came up with that joke?
Oh my goodness. Like a 5-year-old, you know, she just
came up with a legitimately like chuckle worthy joke. Yep. For sure.
And,
yeah, no, I understand
it. And then, you know, the reaction out of me, it was a magical, magical moment. And the first of many poop jokes from her, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. I've not seen Frozen, so I don't know this joke, but I think that's a character from Frozen.
It is a character
and from Frozen. A song. And yeah, there we go.
It is burned into all my right. psyche.
This great episode is now descending rapidly into its own little cave. So maybe we should wrap it up.
All right.
Do we have anything in the mailbag this week?
I checked before we start recording, and unfortunately, we do not have anything at all in the mailbag. And also, through the new year, we have been neglectful in our social media duties, and there's not much to report on from there. But as always, you can send us a message. You can send us an email to coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter, where our handle is
@coreideaspaleo.
And show notes are available on our website. It's kind of like a blog where we do a summary of all the shows Adam to date.
Does. Josh doesn't do any of it.
And we're almost up to date. They're fairly link heavy. If you're interested in doing some of the reading or seeing some of the background reading associated with the individual shows, and that is at our website, coreideas.ajesiorski.ca. But basically find us on Twitter and you'll find the link to the website. And other than that, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Yep. Take care, and we'll see you next time.